Welcome to GI Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with four investigators during the recent GI Cancer Symposium, aka ASCO GI, in San Francisco, and this year's meeting included two landmark presentations of Phase 3 trials that may change practice. Data showing impressive efficacy of nab-paclitaxel plus gemcitabine compared to gemcitabine alone as first-line therapy of metastatic pancreatic cancer, and another study comparing the anti-VEGF antibody ramucirumab as second-line treatment of advanced gastric cancer. I met with the principal investigator of the ramucirumab trial, Dr. Charles Fuchs. But to begin, we chatted about colorectal cancer and the unprecedented flood of new agents and strategies in the past year, including the approval of two new drugs, the VEGF trap aflibercept and the multikinase TKI regorafenib. To begin, Dr. Fuchs commented on the so-called TML study in advanced colorectal cancer, evaluating the continuation of bevacizumab on disease progression.
I think that the TML study is important, it's convincing, and I think that whereas we were potentially giving second line or continuation of Bev into second line based on observational data, we now have sound phase 3 data that it's part of my practice. So many of my patients start with FOLFOX bevacizumab and will then move on to FOLFIRI Bev in second line, and the TML study I think supports that. With regard to regorafenib, I'm certainly using it. The CORRECT study shows a modest benefit, but undeniably robust statistically. And so for patients who have progressed on everything, who aren't eligible for a clinical trial, I give them a prescription for regorafenib. You know, I think that obviously we'd love to see things that have an even greater benefit, but it's now routinely part of my practice for patients with refractory disease who don't have a trial option. And with regard to aflibercept, I think the data look convincing. And as best I can tell, I think Bev and aflibercept are both effective options in second-line therapy. I haven't had the chance to use much aflibercept yet at my center, but I'm looking forward to doing it.
So just to kind of tease this out a little bit, from a theoretical point of view, how are you thinking through second-line therapy, particularly in the EGFR mutant situation in a patient who's gotten, you know, I'm guessing FOLFOX Bev in your practice for first line? How do you decide between continuation of Bev, for example, and aflibercept?
You know, at the moment, I'm using a lot more bevacizumab just because it's been our routine. We have a chemotherapy order entry template where it's sort of templated in. And I think that, you know, my guess is in evolution, there may be more aflibercept use in our practice. We're certainly studying the drug. We're actually studying it in other settings through clinical trials, namely neuroendocrine tumors and gastric cancer. So we're certainly interested in aflibercept. We're using it actually in those clinical trials. And, you know, I anticipate that within our routine practice, we'll use it as well, because I think Bev and aflibercept are equivalent options in the second line, and I'd be comfortable using either.
What's your sense in terms of side effects and toxicity of aflibercept?
That's a great question, because one thing about the VELOR study is there is a somewhat higher rate of toxicities for the chemo plus aflibercept arm compared to chemo alone. And it's not just the AEs, the adverse events characteristically associated with VEGF inhibition. It's also chemo-related toxicities. It's all in the acceptable range. But I think it is interesting that there is a slightly higher rate of chemotherapy-related events in the aflibercept arm. You know, I think in the experience I've had within our clinical trials, I think it's a well-tolerated agent. I don't think it's an issue in second line, but one could stare at the VELOR study and wonder what potentially is driving that slight increase in chemo-related toxicity.
So the one area that I've heard people talk about in terms of, quote, getting their feet wet with the aflibercept is the patient who progresses right through Bev FOLFOX, for example. How do you manage those patients?
Yeah, again, at the moment, have been giving FOLFIRI Bev. I have not yet really had a chance to give aflibercept at the moment. But I think it's a good question. Could aflibercept overcome bevacizumab resistance? Now, what's driving the patient who has bad disease and blows through first-line FOLFOX bevacizumab? Is it the bevacizumab or is it just the chemotherapy? My guess is it's more likely to be the chemotherapy driving it, because it's not clear what is a mechanism of resistance to the sort of VEGF pathway inhibitors.
So how would you contrast the mechanism of action in terms of those two agents, bevacizumab and aflibercept, and what's your concept in terms of the ligands that it binds?
Right. I mean, obviously, aflibercept binds more ligands than bevacizumab. Does that matter in terms of therapeutic benefit? I guess on a theoretical basis, it might. I've even heard people mention that, and you may have heard this as well, Neil, that the toxicity issues witnessed with aflibercept, namely the higher chemo-related toxicity, is related to its ability to bind placental-derived growth factor, where apparently there's data that that particular growth factor is needed for recovery of intestinal mucosa that can sometimes be denuded by chemo. Thereby, if you're giving chemo with aflibercept, it's not the aflibercept that's causing the diarrhea or chemo-related toxicity, but it actually potentially impairs the recovery from chemo because of its ability to bind that additional ligand. Pure speculation, and perhaps I make too much of it because, in earnest, I think if you look at the Valor data in its totality, I think it's a well-tolerated combination.
I mean, there does seem to be a tad more myelosuppression, same kind of thinking, maybe it impairs recovery of the marrow?
You know, it's conceivable, right? I mean, you know, you could imagine that something defined as a placental-derived growth factor might have to do with stem cells in a variety of tissues. And arguably, if that's an issue with respect to recovery from chemotherapy, that it could affect it. But again, it's pure speculation. And I think it's fair to say, do we know that aflibercept plus chemo is any less tolerable than bevacizumab plus chemo? We don't, right? I mean, the comparisons have never been made, and always cross-study comparisons between Valor and TML. That's, you know, that's a dangerous thing to do, and I'm hesitant to make too much of it.
Have you or would you continue Bev, you know, a second time or third time, so to speak?
It's a terrific question, and in fact, I would even take your question to another level, which is, you know, let's say you accept the fact that you're going to get Bev first line and second line, and you have a KRAS wild type patient, right? Let's say you're the kind of guy who gives cetuximab or panitumumab third line as opposed to second. Would you potentially continue Bev with the irinotecan and cetuximab or panitumumab? Now, we know from PACE and CAIRO that combining an EGFR antibody with bevacizumab is a bad thing to do. But we also remember the BOND-2 study that Len Salt published in JCO. As you may recall, that was a successor to BOND-1, which was irinotecan plus cetuximab, in which in BOND-2 he tested the combination of irinotecan, cetuximab, and bevacizumab, double antibody. And that study, published in JCO, suggests that that triplet, combining the antibodies, was more efficacious historically than BOND-1. It really looked like an active regimen. Now, is that because it's just a flawed study and we really shouldn't combine those antibodies? Or is it possible that maybe combining those antibodies is a bad thing in frontline, but not such a bad thing in third line? So we are in the process of trying to put together a study where we can do essentially, for lack of a better phrase, a BOND-3. Where bevacizumab, clearly part of first and second line, should we really retest what was a positive BOND-2 study to do a study, okay, having progressed on first-line chemo-bev, second-line chemo-bev, you're going to go on irinotecan, cetuximab, or panitumumab, plus-minus bev. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable, some might say don't do it because of the results of the front line, but we still have BOND-2, and I think it's still a reasonable question.
I guess the other question is maybe it'll evolve over the long term into not just the question of continuation of Bev, a continuation of anti-angiogenesis, kind of like what's happened in HER2-positive breast cancer, where these patients with HER2-positive disease receive indefinite anti-HER2 therapy, but it's not just trastuzumab. It's all kinds of, you know, lapatinib, all kinds of other agents. There are a lot of anti-angiogenics out there.
It's a great point. And in fact, what we haven't discussed is the notion of, is there an issue with actually discontinuing anti-VEGF therapy, right? That is to say, can you potentially turn something on in the tumor that allows it to progress faster if at some point you stop the Bev, be it after first or second line? And that, in fact, for lack of a better phrase, the benefit of continuing Bev is not so much because it has a continued benefit, but you're preventing that aggressiveness that occurs by discontinuing it. And that has been a theoretical concern. There was a meta-analysis of studies that you probably saw in JCO across breast and colon that suggested that there was not a faster rate of progression in individuals who had stopped Bev. That is, the post-Bev natural history was not worse. But there's still people who believe that that's an issue. And so for either the reasons that just continuing Bev is a good thing lifelong or because of that theoretical concern, I think you're right. This could be a drug that just needs to be, or a pathway that needs to be inhibited through the duration of therapy.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me, of course, this is pretty empiric in terms of, again, another tumor, prostate cancer, where, you know, androgen deprivation has continued for better or worse indefinitely. It also brings up, and a la related to regorafenib, the issue of what is the true spectrum of what's happening today in metastatic colorectal cancer. I'm sure you're aware that your breast group, with Hal Burstein at the lead at the last ASCO meeting, reported data of patients in your institution who with metastatic breast cancer long-term. And, you know, they looked at HER2 positive, HER2 negative, and of course, what they saw was a lot of multiple lines of therapy over the course of disease, particularly HER2 positive disease. We started to kind of look at that a little bit in colorectal cancer in our more simplified way of just doing surveys and say, tell us about the last patient who died with colorectal cancer. How long did they live with the disease? How many lines of therapy? And what we're seeing is like 2 to 4 years, 5 years, 4 to 5 lines of therapy. Does that jive with what you do in your practice?
No, it absolutely does. And in fact, related to your research, we're trying to do sort of complementary research where we've partnered with a vendor of a chemotherapy order, a national chemotherapy order entry system, where they actually download all the orders and to really look at the care of patients with metastatic disease. And you're absolutely right. Patients are getting third, fourth, and fifth line therapies. And we reported that data at ASCO in 2012, so I'm not telling anything that isn't already public available. But what's interesting about that is, you know, no surprise, there's a lot of first-line Bev use. What was surprising to me in that study was there is actually not a lot of anti-EGFR use in the United States. I mean, I knew it was low, but it was actually in the low 20% range of patients ever getting an EGFR antibody in colon cancer, which I thought was staggeringly low. The other point was when KRAS mutational status became part of the label in 2009, you would have thought, well, if it's that low, it'll go up, right? Because you'll know who to give the drug to. It actually went down. It went down to 18% of U.S. patients. So, you know, I think the study will be, we're hoping to publish the study soon. I think it'll be interesting because I think it'll talk about the underutilization of that drug.
What do you think the reason is? Toxicity?
I think patients and oncologists would prefer to spare people the rash, but the drug has a survival benefit. We shouldn't overlook it.
Well, I think also this kind of, again, ties into regorafenib. Most people say, well, you know, the trial looked at a very late line. That's how I'm going to use it. But, I mean, late line just means you've run out of the first couple options, and it doesn't necessarily take you very long to get there nowadays.
Absolutely, and particularly if you have a KRAS mutant patient. But moreover, you know, people are doing so much better. I've been doing this long enough to know that there was a time, well, we really need something second line. Well, we need something fifth line now, right? I mean, we have a reasonable cadre of patients who are into fourth line, into regorafenib, who might progress, who have a reasonable performance status and want to find something to try.
You talked about the reluctance that may be out there to use EGFR antibodies. Are there situations where you'd think about using regorafenib before an EGFR antibody in a patient with a wild-type tumor?
I wouldn't, because I do think that we ought to stick with what these studies demonstrated. Yeah, I guess if you had a patient who totally objected to getting an EGFR antibody, then I would give them regorafenib sooner. But I would certainly encourage people to use either cetuximab or panitumumab in the indication that it was developed before moving to regorafenib, just because we don't have data to that effect.
What's your own experience and what are you seeing in the literature in terms of side effects toxicity with regorafenib?
Yeah, I think much like many of the multi-targeted TKIs, there's toxicity, fatigue, hand, foot, particularly the fatigue that's hard to measure. And you can certainly manage people through it, but it's challenging. It's not a free ride for patients. I think patients intuitively think, well, you've been giving me these IV chemos for all this time. Now you're writing me a prescription. This must be easy. And I think we recognize with regorafenib that it's not easy. It's manageable. But I think you have to pay attention to these patients. You got to ask them about things like fatigue, because I think that's a side effect we don't necessarily do a great job in assessing oncologists. I include myself in that. It's important to keep tabs on these people and help them get through it.
What are some of the research questions about regorafenib that you're interested in and that you're aware of? I could imagine studies looking at an earlier stage disease with chemo. Are these being planned or done?
Oh, absolutely. No, so there are definitely efforts afoot about combining chemotherapy plus regorafenib as a treatment option. The other possibility is combining it with bevacizumab, right? I mean, could you take because if regorafenib is working on the receptor, bevacizumab is hitting the ligand or aflibercept. No, these might be great opportunities to look at. So I think there's a wealth of opportunities. I guess the only thing you have to ask is, okay, without a doubt, regorafenib works as a single agent. It benefits patients. Will it be beneficial adding it to chemotherapy? I hope it is, but the possibility is it won't. Why do I say that? Because when you combine chemotherapy with very similar types of agents, without exception, those trials failed, be it PTK-787, sunitinib, cedarinib, sorafenib. All of those efforts didn't work when you combine them with chemo. Now, maybe regorafenib will be different. I hope so. Maybe those trials weren't properly designed, perhaps. I don't know. But we'll have to wait and see. Based on that, I personally would not advise anybody to combine regorafenib with chemo until we see the results of those trials.
And one question we get a lot from oncologists, because regorafenib is very similar to sorafenib, I think it just added a fluorine molecule to it. Do we know about the single agent activity of sorafenib, or for that matter, some of the other TKIs you mentioned?
Yeah, we really don't, because the companies that developed those molecules in colon were really earnestly convinced that the better opportunities was to combine it with chemo and almost exclusively looked at it. So we really don't. You know, I think your point about the fact that there's just a fluorine moiety difference between sorafenib and regorafenib makes me conclude that they're not very different drugs. And in fact, having given both drugs to patients now, you know, I think even the toxicity profile is remarkably similar.
And I guess that leads to the question of hand-foot syndrome. Does it seem to be the same as sorafenib?
It really does. And also the fatigue, honestly. You know, I know we talk a lot about hand-foot, and again, I don't want to sound like a broken record, but the patient experience with this drug, my patients talk a lot more about fatigue than they talk about any other side effect.
A couple other issues we were talking before about EGFR antibodies that I wanted to ask you about. The first is, and again, these are reflecting questions we get from oncologists all the time. They've heard a lot about the issue of the codon 13 mutation. Can you kind of go through that and what you think about it?
Of course. Well, biologically, it's an interesting hypothesis. Namely, if you look at when you insert a KRAS mutation into cells and thereby transform them into a malignant phenotype, codon 12 mutations are much more potent than codon 13. And that's been shown. That is, you can make a cell much more malignant if you give it a codon 12 mutant as opposed to a codon 13. So there was a prior for this. And since then, we've actually seen a number of studies, observational studies, retrospective at times, or in fact exclusively, that said that cetuximab actually clearly does not work in codon 12 mutants, but it appears to have a benefit in the codon 13 patients akin to wild type. And albeit they're small studies, frequently they're retrospective, it does give you pause that maybe the codon 13 patients could be the patients to give an EGFR inhibitor. Then we're actually seeing now in this year in JCO a subsequent paper looking at the compilation of the panitumumab trials where they don't see a benefit for codon 13. So whether you had codon 12 or 13, panitumumab doesn't work. So I guess the answer is the jury's not in. Would I give a patient with a codon 13 mutation an EGFR inhibitor? Well, candidly, I have. That is, in those patients where I'm really out of options, I have said to them there are these limited studies that suggest there may still be a benefit if there's a codon 13 mutation. It's by no means conclusive. If that's something you want to try, we can do it. And I've had a handful of patients who wanted to try.
Now, being in Boston, you're outside the cetuximab reaction belt, so I'm curious which EGFR antibody you tend to use first, and do you ever circle back to the next one?
Yes. So we principally use cetuximab just because historically we've been doing it, and we don't see much in the way of cetuximab-related hypersensitivity in contrast, for instance, North Carolina and that region of the country. Which is really interesting you asked me, because 2 weeks ago, the first time in years, I had a patient who had a hypersensitivity reaction to cetuximab, and so I, this week, switched her to panitumumab for that very reason. We did a study at our center to look at the efficacy of panitumumab in cetuximab failures. We recently published that result. I think we enrolled 20-odd patients. We just didn't see any activity. And I say that because in that earlier study I mentioned, looking at patterns of care across the U.S., 40% of patients receiving panitumumab had previously received cetuximab. So that's a lot of what the panitumumab use is, apparently, in the United States right now.
So just to finish out on colon cancer, let's talk a bit about adjuvant treatment. And I'm curious what your take is on the paper that was presented at last year's ASCO meeting where they went back and did Oncotype DX assays on patients on the classic NSABP-B07 oxali versus not trial. And this seemed to show that the assay was prognostic in both stage 2 and 3 disease. And then, very interestingly, they tried to correlate the excess benefit from oxali with the recurrence score. Our group had a poster here showing a lot of oxali use in both stage 2 and 3 disease. What do you think about this whole line of research?
You know, it's interesting that there is so much use of oxali in stage 2, particularly with the latest update from Mosaic. I really have curtailed my use of oxali in stage 2 disease, and you know, I applaud the effort that you've done because we really have to better understand this. The drug is relatively well tolerated, but I think the neuropathy is considerable. I think we've learned since the original publication of Mosaic that these people have neuropathy for the rest of their lives. I honestly believe that 5 years later, they're perfectly healthy and they're functional, but they'll tell you, when I walk on a bare floor, it's not the same. When I jog on the treadmill, it's not the same. And so I think that we have to be really thoughtful about who we expose this drug to people. And I think part of it is to be more selective about how we use it. I think the other is, I really think that the current intergroup study of 6 versus 12 months of FOLFOX, 6 versus 12 cycles, rather 3 versus 6 months, I think is really important. I hope 3 months is the same as 6, but until that study is done, we obviously shouldn't deviate.
Well, let me ask you, if it does turn out that from an efficacy point of view, 3 months is the same, do you think it's going to make that much different to neuropathy?
I think so. I really do think so, because I think there's a cumulative effect. You know, if you go to the original Mosaic data, people got on a median 9 cycles, not 12. I think it's when you get past the 6th cycle is when you really start running into the acute issues, and I think it's those people that then run into the long-term issues. You're right that you're not going to completely eliminate neuropathy by limiting it to 6 cycles, but I think it'll make a difference.
Well, the other thing that we asked that was kind of interesting was, how much absolute benefit do you think is needed to justify adding oxali? The answer that was given, of course, is a little bit of a splay, was about 5%. Then you look at their cases and you add the numbers up and you look at their numbers, what they gave us.
And it was less.
And it's less.
Yeah,
so there's kind of an internal inconsistency.
Well, you know, I think that's the difference between GI oncologists and breast oncologists. The breast oncologists are honest. I think, you know, their studies are designed to find differences less than 5% and they act on it. We design studies for bigger differences, but we still act on the smaller ones.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned breast because, you know, we first started doing CME in colorectal cancer, you know, which is quite a while ago, more than 10 years ago, there was definitely not the kind of numeracy you see in practice. But I think that's changed. I think the numbers are there. And actually, the numbers that the docs are giving us in practice are right on, same as the investigators. I think they're giving them to their patients.
No, I think you're right. And in fact, to ASCO's credit, as you know, the current statement is to tell patients that on average, adjuvant chemotherapy in stage 2 disease provides about a 2% benefit. That's what they think we should be telling patients. And, you know, that's a pretty small difference to act on.
What about genomic predictors like Oncotype as a way to figure out who benefits from oxali?
I think it's somewhat challenging to really differentiate chemo approaches in stage 3 disease. At least I worry a little bit about it because you're talking about node-positive colon cancer where historically, on average, there has been a reasonably good chance of recurrence and where I think the benefits of chemotherapy are pretty tangible. And so You know, I think that if one could come up with a marker to define who to give oxali to or not in stage three, that's interesting, though I'd really want to have great confidence in it. I think where I really would love to see an opportunity is, let's take the 3 versus 6 months of phenomenon, where it may be that one size doesn't fit all. And I bet it doesn't in stage three disease. And what I would say is, as opposed to all or nothing, what about the idea of taking that trial and using Oncotype and saying, okay, let's say it's equivalent. But you and I know, colon cancer is not a homogeneous disease. And there may be people buried within that trial, because it's going to be 2,500 patients, where you do want to give 6 months to, and where it will make a difference measurably. And so if we could biologically define that, that trial is going to be a gold mine for that type of biological assessment, I think.
So you have maybe the data set of the year here at the GI Cancer Symposium, looking at ramucirumab in advanced gastric cancer. Can you talk a little bit about what you're reporting?
Sure. So ramucirumab, as you know, is an antibody against the VEGF receptor 2, and I think a well-tolerated, interesting antibody that we wanted to study in gastric cancer, namely in second-line therapy. So patients who had progressed on front-line therapy that contained either a fluoropyrimidine or platinum at progression, randomized to single-agent ramucirumab or best supportive care. We recognize that, obviously, best supportive care is a tricky thing for us to do as oncologists, but recognize there is no approved second-line therapy in the U.S. or in Europe in gastric cancer. So we did a 2-to-1 randomization. 1/3 of patients got best supportive care. We enrolled 355 patients. And the bottom line is patients who got ramucirumab had a statistically significant improvement in overall survival, which is the primary endpoint, and a significant improvement in progression-free survival. And then lastly, if you look at the toxicity profile compared to placebo, really with the notable exception of hypertension, very well tolerated, and for the most part, there was higher adverse events recorded in the placebo arm than there was in the ramucirumab arm. So I would conclude from the study, I think it's an agent that has activity in second line. The benefit is comparable to what you would see with docetaxel or irinotecan in second line in this disease, and I would say the toxicity profile is probably superior to chemotherapy.
I was kind of surprised to see a monotherapy trial. You know, a lot of the anti-angiogenic strategies, Bev, aflibercept, et cetera, have been with chemotherapy. What was the thinking or what had been observed previously that led to this phase 3 study?
Well, in phase 1, there were actually patients with gastric cancer who seemed to benefit to the single agent. And we really thought that as a proof of principle, it was valuable to know what this antibody does on its own in gastric cancer, because there's ample evidence that the VEGF pathway is important in stomach cancer. There are studies that show that circulating VEGF and VEGF and VEGFR2 expression in tumors predicts survival. Quite a few studies, fairly robust. So we really felt that just the antibody alone was worth studying. Now, that being said, there is a completed study looking in the same space, second line, in which patients at the time of progression of first line are being randomized to either paclitaxel or paclitaxel plus ramucirumab. So that study, the RAINBOW study, is complete. I bet we'll see data from that later this year. But we thought it was important to do both studies and to really understand what the antibody by itself can accomplish.
Can you talk a little bit more about the numbers in terms of what you actually saw in the hazard rates?
Of course. So in terms of median survival, we saw with the antibody a median survival of 5.3 months and 3.8 months in placebo, so 5.3 versus 3.8. Now, I know that seems modest, but if you look, for instance, at the studies of docetaxel or irinotecan versus best supportive care, and one example of such study was Park et al., published in the JCO just in 2012, exactly that design, they found almost exactly the same outcome, 5.3 months for docetaxel irinotecan, 3.8 months for placebo. So, and similarly, at this year's GI ASCO, the Cougar study, which was a study conducted in Great Britain of docetaxel versus best supportive care, almost exactly the same median survival. So I would take the data and say the benefit of ramucirumab looks almost identical to chemotherapy.
Actually, adding it up, it sounds a lot like the benefit that was seen in the TML study in colon cancer with Bev, as well as the aflibercept, as well as regorafenib.
1.4. You know, 1.5. Yeah, 1.4. All four of those studies is 1.4. I think we got to play the lottery here. I mean, that seems to be the number.
Right. What about responses and progression-free survival?
So absolutely, improvement in progression-free survival with a p-value of less than 10 to the minus 4th, with a hazard ratio of 0.48, so a 52% improvement in progression-free survival. When people hopefully get a chance to see the Kaplan-Meier curves for both overall and progression-free survival, I think they'll find it convincing, as we tried to show at GI ASCO. With respect to response, relatively low, much like, for instance, you know, regorafenib, a 3% or 3.5% response rate with the drug. Now, I want to point out that you might say, well, you know, that's less than we see with docetaxel. But the Cougar study, a study of docetaxel, also reported out at GI ASCO, has a 7% response. So is 3.5 all that different from 7? I don't know, particularly because these are all investigator assessed.
So we're about to submit an abstract to ASCO, another simple survey that we did of 100 oncologists in practice, asking them about their experiences and sort of feelings about 22 drugs that have been approved in the last 2 to 3 years. Kind of an interesting commentary, particularly since only two were cytotoxics. Sounds to me like maybe ramucirumab is about to get on that list.
I hope so. I think this is a great option for patients because let's imagine the drug's approved, and you and I have no idea whether it will or won't be. But you sit down with a patient and you say, look, here's a monoclonal antibody. It gets you the same benefit as irinotecan or docetaxel with a lot better toxicity, much less toxicity. Which would you choose? I think patients would opt for the antibody. They might say, okay, if it doesn't work, you'll give me the docetaxel. But I actually think that this is a great thing to make available to patients.
What are some of the other tumor types where ramucirumab is being looked at?
Of course. Well, there's actually, as I mentioned, a companion study of paclitaxel with the antibody in second-line gastric, the RAINBOW study. There's a study that was completed in breast cancer, which is docetaxel, first-line docetaxel, with or without the antibody. I believe that study is completed. We may even see PFS data from that trial later this year. There's a trial in sorafenib failures in hepatocellular carcinoma, in which in second line, so having failed sorafenib, patients randomized to ramucirumab or placebo or best supportive care. I think a really interesting study about the use of the drug second line. There's a study of second line colon cancer, in which having failed frontline FOLFOX, you're being randomized to FOLFIRI with or without ramucirumab, almost the same design as VELOR. And then lastly, there's a chemotherapy plus minus RAM in non-small cell lung cancer. So a number of opportunities to study this drug in major diseases.
It'll be interesting. You know, one thing, gastric cancer, where as you say, you kind of run out of options real fast with some of the other tumors you talked about, particularly breast cancer with all the controversy that's going on with Bev and now nobody uses Bev anymore. Be interesting to see, you know, if they turn out with a progression-free survival without overall survival benefit, whether people end up using it, given what happened with the Bev.
It's so funny. You take the words right out of my mouth. I was thinking the same thing, which is, what happens if that study has a PFS benefit and not a significant survival benefit, which is not unlikely because, you know, you give these women 6-7 additional lines of therapy. How do you manage survival, right? So it'll be interesting what the take is because one scenario of interest is, let's say there's a significant PFS benefit in the breast study, and there's actually a real trend in survival, but it's not P of 0.05. Is that a reason to reject it? I don't know.
It was a reason to get rid of Bev.
Well, but Bev had a hazard ratio for survival that was, you know, 1.07 or something, right? So it didn't trend in the right direction.
I see, yeah.
Whereas, again, we don't know what the data will be, but even if it's not significant, if that hazard ratio is less than 1, and let's say it's 0.85, I don't know, if I was a breast cancer patient, I might want to do it.
There are a lot of docs who like to use Bev right now without the survival benefit, and, you know, triple negative or people who need a response, et cetera, but that is a story for another time. Anything else going on in gastric cancer? I'm curious where things are in terms of HER2 positives, if you're talking about breast cancer. You know, we saw the TOGA data with trastuzumab. I think there's a study here looking at lapatinib. Where are we with this strategy?
Well, I think that the absolute standard of care in gastric and esophageal adenocarcinoma, at the time of diagnosis, we have to check HER2 status. And if it's positive, they get the frontline chemo plus trastuzumab. But, you know, there are obviously other options, which include lapatinib, which I think is one opportunity. The other is GI oncologists, we're fairly unoriginal, but we certainly know how to copy well. And so I think some of the things that are being done in breast cancer, be it pertuzumab, T-DM1, these are great things to be doing in gastric cancer, and that's what's going on. People are actually doing it. So I think these are wonderful opportunities to really understand the HER2 pathway in stomach cancer.
So you have a case from your practice here of a patient with a HER2-positive gastric cancer.
Right. So this was a ECOG-0, 61-year-old woman who came in with metastatic gastric cancer, principally liver metastases. Her primary was still intact. The pathology showed that it was 3-plus IHC positive, and so obviously somebody we would want to give trastuzumab to. And we actually gave her FOLFOX and trastuzumab. And admittedly, I know that the TOGA study used FU platinum. Our center, we really have used FOLFOX principally as our first-line chemotherapy for gastric cancer. She actually had a great response and, you know, in the setting of gastric cancer, had a duration of response about 8 months until at that point she developed progression within her liver metastases.
So at that point, what was she receiving?
She was just on FU leucovorin and trastuzumab because I'd say at about my recollection, about the 5-month mark or so, I had sort of started to whittle down on the oxali, you know, gone to 65, 55. But then I just told her, let's just stop it. And so she was just on FU leucovorin and trastuzumab.
So what were the options that you thought about at that point?
Well, I will tell you, and she asked me because we have patients like this. This is somebody who has scoured the literature and became familiar with trastuzumab and breast cancer. My recollection is she may have even known some folks who had used it in breast cancer. And so she asked me specifically that whatever chemotherapy we're going to use, could we continue the trastuzumab? And I said to her, there's no evidence in gastric cancer of continuing it. And so I wound up giving her just single-agent docetaxel without the trastuzumab. But I did struggle with it because, you know, she's a very well-educated woman, and she's done okay on the docetaxel. She's got essentially stable disease. She's tolerating it fine. I'm giving it weekly. We had such a robust response to the FOLFOX trastuzumab. You know, it's a great question, which is, should we continue it much like breast cancer? I didn't because, well, I try to be evidence-based, and I told her that. And I think she's accepting of it. She hasn't said to me, why didn't you keep going with the trastuzumab?
I got to say, if it had been me, I'd be saying, I want that trastuzumab because what do I have to lose?
Yeah, I hear you. The world's changing, right? I mean, everything is now templated. You got to get approval for these things. We have templated order entry sets for our patients with gastric cancer and across all the diseases. So I have a single agent docetaxel schedule for gastric cancer. I could have applied for the trastuzumab and maybe would have been approved for it, but I chose not to in the absence of any evidence.
Now, if ramucirumab were approved, what would you think about that for her?
Oh, let me tell you, if in this setting, if ramucirumab was approved, I would have offered it because I would have said to her, look, you've got two options. I can give you docetaxel. I can give you ramucirumab. The studies suggest roughly equivalent survival benefit. The toxicity is much better with ramucirumab. And my guess is, knowing her, she would have gladly taken it. I mean, because I think she actually has a belief that biologics work. I mean, she's benefited from trastuzumab. She would have gladly taken the ramucirumab.
Now, at the time she progressed, how long has she been off the oxali?
When she went on docetaxel, she was off it for over 3.5 months.
I mean, would that have been a consideration, adding back the oxali and keeping the 5-FU and trastuzumab going?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly think about it in colon cancer. I just think because the natural history in this disease is so much shorter, I was reluctant to try something that I thought might fail.
What about the use of neoadjuvant anti-HER therapy with chemo and gastric cancer? Any situations where you think about it? Are there any trials looking at it?
Absolutely. No, there's an RTOG study in which in HER2-positive esophageal cancer where it's being added to neoadjuvant chemo radiation, and I think that's a really important effort. In patients with, for instance, we see a fair number of patients who have gastric cancer where it's already been resected. In fact, I'd say more often than not in New England, The patients I give adjuvant therapy to gastric cancer are coming to my practice after their gastrectomy. And, you know, routinely we give fluoropyrimidine radiation post-adjuvant therapies, but my center, we do the HER2 staining on everybody, including the resection specimens. And I've had a few who are HER2 positive. I have not used trastuzumab in the adjuvant setting outside of a clinical trial, but I think it's a question that really needs to be addressed soon.
Suppose you were in that situation yourself.
Boy, you put me in a tough spot. You know, I try to tell patients that I wouldn't ask them to do something I wouldn't do myself. And so, look, we've done a lot of things in colon cancer that are effective in metastatic disease that have failed in the adjuvant setting. Bevacizumab, cetuximab, right? So I think we as physicians are intuitively thoughtful of more is better. But in the adjuvant setting, it hasn't always panned out. So do I lose any sleep that I haven't been doing it with trastuzumab? I don't, because we've even seen circumstances where adding something in the adjuvant setting could make matters worse.
So you've got a 42-year-old lady here with colon cancer, kind of gets into this issue of second and third line therapy. What do you talk about her?
Yeah, this is a marathon runner who, you think about how people develop colon cancer, because this woman is a phenomenal athlete. And when I met her, she was in great shape and presented with a KRAS mutant metastatic colon cancer, perfectly asymptomatic, but regrettably had both lung and liver metastases, even had some peritoneal disease.
How was it picked up?
She actually got in an automobile accident and got a chest x-ray.
Wow.
And that's how it got picked up, because she truly was asymptomatic. And I can tell you, any physician who saw her for an ache or pain would have dismissed it, because this woman, she is a phenomenal athlete, a dedicated runner. So it was really found by accident. She ended up getting a colonoscopy ultimately to figure out where the primary was, and then, you know, found it. And she did well, actually, on frontline FOLFOX bevacizumab, and then on FOLFIRI-BEV. She had stable disease and then ultimately progressed and recently started her on regorafenib, which she's tolerating very well. She tolerates everything quite well. Remains to be seen. I haven't yet gotten to her first CAT scan yet, and I haven't been in a tremendous rush to look, because she's tolerating the regorafenib. In contrast to many of my patients, I'd say she's probably tolerating it better than most.
You know, she also brings up the question of the management of the patient with coincident primary metastatic colon cancer where the primary is asymptomatic. Seems like there's definitely been a shift towards using systemic therapy, but there was a presentation at ASCO, kind of a retrospective look that suggested or purported to say patients do better if they have their primaries taken out. Where do you stand on that?
I think that's a great question. The studies have said, these are purely observational studies, saying that the patients who had their primary out had a better survival than those where the primary was left in place. But they're not randomized trials, right? They're pure observational studies. Why did the people not get their primaries out? Is it because they were too sick? They had too much disease? So if you don't find that the people who got their primaries out in a retrospective look, I'd be shocked, right? Because there's a selection bias. So I personally am not persuaded that there really is a survival benefit to removing the primary. And so I don't feel strongly about it. That being said, the surgeons at my center are apt to remove it. They believe that patients with colon cancer are living longer and that they're going to run into trouble with the primary eventually. And so why not remove it, because colectomies are so easy to do and the recovery is so prompt. So, you know, I don't feel strongly to argue against it, but I'm perfectly comfortable giving chemotherapy to patients with the primary intact.
I guess the other issue is, how do you monitor the primary? And this lady, I guess you have to do a colonoscopy.
I think if you need to, but honestly, I think you can manage people through just following their symptoms, as well as, I think if there's a significant change on the primary, you'll probably see something on the CT scan. You know, in earnest, her problems now are more about her peritoneal disease, and she is getting symptomatic from that.
Any local modalities that you think about in that situation?
Obviously, there are surgeons who believe in cytoreductive surgery, intraperitoneal heated chemotherapy, and where they offer sort of uncontrolled data that their patients do better than most who they operate on. I think one has to be really careful about that literature, because those surgeons are very selective about who they take to the OR. They turn down patients with more abundant disease. And so who's to say that their patients who get the surgery aren't doing better because they just select the better patients?
So I know you're kind of almost trying not to document progression in her situation, because I guess the question is, if she does progress, what's next?
Yeah, well, she's an excellent phase one candidate. She's hip, so she knows about phase one studies, and she knows that they're unlikely to ever work, just because statistically we test a lot of drugs and a lot of them fail. So she's, my guess is, when and if regorafenib fails, she'll go on a phase one at our center. But as I say, she's feeling good, she's enjoying her work, her family. I'm not rushing to find out, but I will obviously restage her.
If she comes in and says, I hear about this newly approved drug of aflibercept, how about that?
It's a terrific question. And, you know, it has occurred to me with, you know, having failed everything else, would I potentially try aflibercept with chemotherapy? That obviously was not the intent of the Valor study. And so I have not done it. That is to give aflibercept to people who have failed everything, though I know there are oncologists who have done it.